Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.
It's a real joy to invite our next keynote speaker back to Australia, back to Melbourne, back to our family. It is so good to have David Smith as part of our team, our friendship group, our family. He is a wonderful, inspiring, challenging speaker, and it's great to have him with us. David is actually the Director of Graduate Studies in Education and the Director of the Kyres Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Kelvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He also serves as a senior editor of the International Journal of Christianity and Education. His most recent book is Teaching and Christian Practices, which he co-authored with his colleague, but not relative, James Smith. And if you're like me and jumped on Facebook to try to find David Smith, guess what? There's about 14 million of them. But don't go looking on Facebook for David Smith. Instead, go to a fantastic site called Music is Good. Music is Good, where you'll find that David Smith is a prolific reviewer of alternative music. Please join me in welcoming David Smith to our conference.
Thank you, Simon. Good morning. It's always a pleasure to be back in the land of good tea, strange football and excruciating ties. Takes a long time to get here, but it's worth it. Can't actually see you. The light's pretty bright from the top here. I trust there are people out there. Struggled for a while with what to share with you on this occasion. Partly knowing that I've been around Australia a little bit the last couple of years, and various subgroups of you have probably heard me talk about different things in different places, and of course others of you haven't. So the title that I gave Chris Parker a while back was Imagination, Practice, and the Temptations of the Everyday, which is still a fair description of where I'm going. I want to talk about the relationship between imagination and practice. How do the stories in our heads relate to the things we do with our bodies when we're in classrooms? And what happens when all of the beautiful inspirational stories, when the big picture categories, when the grand narratives run into everyday classroom practices? Tests, tables, chairs, students, headaches, and so on. But I decided, thinking as I prepared a little more, that given that there's such an emphasis on stories at this conference, that what I really needed to do was to tell a story. So this is my replacement starting slide. I'm going to tell you a story in seven episodes. And like a lot of books, it has a preface. The preface is where I try to isolate the question that I'm going to be focusing on, the question that's going to guide my story. The question goes like this. If you look at the way this conference has been set up, the paragraphs that have been on the website, talking about cultural stories and the gospel story and how we need to be able to read both, how we need to understand the intersections between them, the relationships between them. How do we live in this space between the cultural story and the biblical story? I want to ask, what about this other story in the middle? What about the story that your classroom is telling? Not you and your words necessarily, but the way your classroom's set up, the way your school works, the discipline policies, the way you use time, where you stand, whether you stand, what tone of voice you use, what kind of gestures you use. What happens from the moment you walk into school to the moment you walk home? And what story is that telling? And how does that relate to these big stories that we've been talking about? So chapter one. Once upon a time, there was an 18-year-old in England who was just finishing secondary school. His name was Smith. And he was a pretty convinced atheist. I remember having debates with friends on the school bus in my last year at school. I was pretty convinced that Christianity was something that a few old ladies comforted themselves with in the face of the inevitable at the local historic Anglican church, but that it didn't have a lot to do with anything that was particularly relevant to an ambitious 18-year-old. I think I learned that partly at school. My family wasn't churched in any way, so I didn't really have connections with Christianity outside of school. But at school, we had compulsory religious education, but religion was never really mentioned in any subject area other than religious education. And we all knew that religious education wasn't an important subject. It wasn't one that would actually help you get a job. If you failed that one, it would have zero effect on your future chances. So it was pretty clear that religion, while it might be interesting for a few curious people to talk about, didn't have much to do with anything. I went away to college, and in my first semester at college, a parting of the ways took place. As we just heard, it's a long story. I have told it on other occasions. But I'm going to do the one-sentence version today. I became a Christian after a semester at college, with a sense that this really ought to change everything. That if God exists, it changes everything. I remember thinking during my first semester at college that if I don't know whether God exists, then how do I plan my Saturday evening? I mean, just concretely. I thought if God doesn't exist, there are no ultimate consequences to anything. Right? As long as you avoid the really bad temporal consequences, as long as you don't get yourself put in prison, harm anybody too seriously, then the rest of it, there are no consequences. You get a certain number of years, you die, the worms get you. That's it. So what else would those years be for but to have the best time possible? But if God did exist, didn't have much theology, but I had this vague idea that you might have to explain stuff one day. And so this question of whether God existed or didn't exist really made it very hard to plan Saturday evening. So it became this really practical question for me as a first-year undergraduate student, and after a semester of wrestling with it, I became a Christian. I was then part of a very enthusiastic evangelical student group for the next 4 years. Went to a large number of Bible studies, prayer meetings, missions talks, mission trips, evangelistic events. Spent way too much of my money in Christian bookstores. Bought books, t-shirts, badges, sweatshirts, bumper stickers, and just generally got involved, was pretty keen. And then I got to the last year of my studies, and this next difficult question arose, which was, what was I going to do after college? And the problem here was there was more than two options. It wasn't just did God exist or not, it was what out of the hundreds of options was I going to do with the rest of my life? The only thing I knew for sure was that I was not going to be a teacher. Because I already knew I was bad at that. And so again, what do you do? My first semester of my final year, I remember I just set about to pray and fast. I prayed and fasted for several days, seriously asking God, call me, send me somewhere, show me what you want me to do with the rest of my life. I was pretty earnest about it. I was a very earnest 22-year-old. And what came back was very surprising, because if God had been a good evangelical, what he should have done was call me to the mission field in a country that didn't have electricity. Because that was really the optimal way to serve God. And instead, about as clearly as I've ever heard anything, and again, it's a long story cut short, I heard God call me to be a teacher. Seriously? A teacher? Not even a Bible teacher, because I've been studying languages. I was studying German and Russian at the time. If I was going to be a teacher, I was going to be a language teacher. I was going to explain grammar to kids. What does that have to do with the kingdom of God? How is that useful? Can't even be the kind of teacher that gets to debate philosophy, like Mark. But just a language teacher. I felt like I'd applied for the CEO's position and been offered the janitorial post. And as I wrestled with that, which actually took me several years, I realized that in my head, one of the stories that I'd learned was one that said that there was a hierarchy of callings, that there were some roles that were closer to God than others, that were more Christian than others, that counted more as Christian service than others. I wasn't alone in this. One of the churches in the group of churches I was in England did a survey of their adults and found that 7 out of 10 of their adult males wanted to go into full-time Christian ministry, which is not economically sustainable. So I'd imbibed this story that there was this hierarchy of callings, that if you were really spiritual, if you were really committed, then you would be a missionary, preferably in Africa. If you were a little bit less committed than that, you could be a pastor in your own country. If you weren't quite that spiritual, you could be a youth minister. And sort of be like a pastor with tattoos. If you were kind of a bit less spiritual than that, you could be a nurse, because at least that was being kind to people. Then teacher was somewhere around the middle of the list. And then if you were totally backslidden and useless, you could become a business person or a rock star or a politician. Now, what got me thinking out of this experience was that I don't remember anyone ever preaching this sermon to me. I don't remember anyone ever standing up and saying, this is the hierarchy of callings, here's the best one, here's the next best one. And yet I knew it pretty clearly. So how did I learn that, if it wasn't learned through somebody talking to me? I started thinking about that. I went to a bookstore around this time. I liked hanging out in used bookstores. And I bought these two books on the same day for a few pence each, both about 100 years old. The one on the left is called Deeper Experiences of Famous Christians. And the one on the right is called Eminent Victorian Philanthropists, or Eminent Christian Philanthropists. Two books. The one on the left, when I dug into it, just by this guy, looks a bit like Simon. Any relative? No. It was a collection of single chapter biographies of different Christians from around the world, from several hundred years of Christian history, one chapter on each person about great deep experiences they'd had with the Holy Spirit. And as I read through the chapter titles, and there's chapters in there on George Fox and John Wesley and George Whitfield and Christmas Evans and Charles Finney and Madame Guyon and so on, and just by being in the church for 4 years, and hanging out in Christian meetings and Christian bookstores and so on, I'd heard of two-thirds of these people. This was familiar ground. I knew most of these stories, even though, as I said, they covered several hundred years and quite a few countries. I picked up the other book, and this was also a collection of one-chapter biographies, all of people in England, in my own country, from just over 100 years ago, who'd been involved in changing society in various ways, who had set up societies to prevent cruelty to animals, who had reformed care of the mentally ill, who had reformed the poor laws, who had been involved in all kinds of ways in changing the social fabric of the country that I lived in ways that actually helped to explain the way things are now. And I'd heard of two of them. There was a chapter on Wilberforce and there was a chapter on Hannah More. But the rest of them I'd never heard of. And I thought, why did we stop telling the one set of stories and keep telling the other set of stories? Why do we have this weird version of church history where it's only made up of pastors and missionaries, when people were doing so many other interesting things, and we've just stopped telling those stories? And what kind of horizon of expectation does it create for us if these are the stories that we're hearing? And the other thing I found was that as I read missionary stories and so on, that the plot usually went something like this. Joe Bloggs, who was called to be a missionary, had a promising career in medicine, in the sciences, and they gave it all up to go to the mission field. And this was the heroic moment where you give up all your worldly prospects to go serve the Lord on the mission field. So again, part of the heroic arc of these narratives was that the way you serve God is by getting out of your worldly work and laying it down to go serve the Lord somewhere else. And I started realizing that the way the church told stories, not the big bad secular culture, the way the church told stories had shaped the way I was able to receive God's calling. When I went to the Christian bookstore, I plowed through a lot of Christian biographies in my first 5 years as a Christian. But you go to your local Christian bookstore and try to find a biography that's not about a pastor, an evangelist, or a missionary. There might be one or two. There's the occasional sports hero these days. But there's a lot of people missing. And when they're not books about evangelists and pastors and so on, the rest of the books in the Christian bookstore I tend to find are mostly about prayer, sex, and money, which are all good. But again, there's a few potential topics missing. So again, as I was exposed to Christian literature, it was giving me a certain horizon. When I went to prayer meetings, what did we pray for? What do you pray for in your prayer meetings? In the prayer meetings I went to, we prayed for missionaries, we prayed for pastors, we prayed for unsaved friends to come to know the Lord, we prayed for sick friends and relatives, we sometimes prayed for people we know who didn't have a job, and that was about it. We almost never even prayed for some of the things the New Testament directly says you should pray for, like the government. And we certainly didn't pray for anybody who was working in the sciences, or for local business people, or for anybody in the arts, or for the local poet. I remember my wife and I got put in charge of the prayer meetings at our church at one point, and one of the things we started doing was having a Friday evening prayer meeting where we'd invite someone to share who wasn't in full-time Christian ministry. And I remember going up to a guy at my church who owned a clothing factory and actually had a profound Christian vision for how he was organizing this factory for the flourishing of the people who were working for him, trying to develop their gifts. In fact, he took pride in developing them and having them move on to better jobs out of his workplace. And I asked him to come along to our prayer meeting and share. He was an elder in our church. He'd been there 20 years. He preached regularly. And when I asked him to come to our prayer meeting so that we could pray for his factory, his jaw hit the floor. Nobody had ever asked him that before. So I learned from prayer meetings that you pray for spiritual things. When I heard sermons, if there were illustrations in the sermon, they would be from the life of John Wesley, George Whitefield, Billy Graham, Charles Finney. And if somebody got called up to the front of church, think about this in a church service, somebody gets called up to the front of church and everybody gathers around to pray for them. What does that mean is about to happen? Usually it means they're about to go on a mission trip in churches I've been in. We don't usually call people to the front of the church and pray for them if they're about to make important hiring decisions in their business, or if they're working in medical research and are trying to get a breakthrough, or if they're in the arts and are looking for inspiration. So in all of these ways, I could go on, but what I'm getting at here is the story that I learned about what it meant to be called wasn't from what people said, it was from the practices that I was embedded in. It was from the way we went about doing things, the stories we told and didn't tell, the things we prayed for and didn't pray for, the things we used as illustrations and didn't use, the people we invited to the front and the people we didn't. That taught me a story. Well, I resigned myself to becoming a teacher because arguing with God didn't seem a theologically good idea. And so I went into a teacher education program and began to learn to teach. And I think at this point, I actually started to read things about Christian worldview and about the big narrative of the gospel and all the good things we've been talking and hearing about this weekend, and I was pretty fired up. I was going to go into schools, and I was going to bring the gospel. I was going to transform education for the kingdom of God by Christmas. In fact, I think my self-image was kind of like this at the time. It was pretty clear that most of education didn't get it, and I, who had been thinking about education for all of about 3 months, was going to come and transform everything. And so then I went through my teacher ed program. I wrote some pretty feisty essays for my professors, making Christian arguments about stuff that I thought they were wrong about. And then I went on my student teaching semester. And I discovered that the progression from sort of enthusiastic crusading beginner to mid-career burnout took about 4 weeks. I remember some days coming home from school and just sitting and weeping because I was so emotionally exhausted. I remember one day teaching a class which I hope will permanently stand as the low watermark of my teaching career, when I basically made a large word search in French and let the children do it while I sat in the corner and nursed my headache. One day I made the rookie mistake of turning around too long writing on the blackboard without looking behind what was going on. And when I turned to face the class again, a boy in the front row had undressed. Just to see how I would react. What I did, which I still think might have been the right response, was I laughed, asked him to get dressed again, and carried on teaching French. But I just started to discover that the classroom is not as malleable as one might hope. That you can't just come in with a glorious story and have that story sweep all before it. The classroom's a recalcitrant place. It has its own resistances. It has its own barriers, its own challenges. And it's just plain hard work. I survived student teaching, just barely. I came within one observation of being failed out of my teacher education program. And embarked on my teaching career. Didn't let go of this idea that if God had called me to be a teacher, then I needed to be intentional about being a Christian teacher. I needed to figure out what that was. I remember being particularly challenged, not just by the big stories, but by some incidents in my classroom. I remember one day I was teaching a speaking test. My students were speaking in French and German, having it recorded and sent away to the examination board. And I sat opposite a 16-year-old trying to speak German into a microphone, looking at his face. And it suddenly hit me that I had never seen this student's face before. I mean, I could pick him out of a crowd. I knew what he looked like. I knew what his name was. I called on him in class every day. But you know how when you really slow down and look into someone's face and they become not just a configuration of features in your environment, but you really see who they are? I sat looking at his face and I thought, I've never seen this person before. And they've been in my classroom for a year. That's scary. That my students can be objects in my environment that I need to navigate and never become people to me. I remember standing in class another day and it suddenly hitting me that all my students were going to die. Not that day, but eventually. And that meant that time for them, as for me, was a finite resource. And that every hour that I spent in class with them was an hour of their life that they would never get back. And that I was the one most responsible for what kind of experience they had in that hour. And whether it contributed to their growth or not. And so I started trying to think about the rhythms and practices of my classroom. How do I figure this out in a way that I actually commit my classroom patterns to the flourishing of my students, to their growth, to their humanity, rather than it being organized around my convenience and crunching them through the system and covering things? Time passed and I discovered this wasn't as easy as it looked. I was teaching French and German and a little bit of Russian in a secondary school. And I was often teaching beginners, and so we would practice things like family trees. We would learn the words for my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, my sister, my brother. And of course, my whole purpose in teaching this vocabulary was to try to make sure that as many kids in my classroom as possible knew these 10 words. It was an inconvenience if they had complicated family trees, because it just made it harder. Or I would teach words for jobs, and again, I just wanted them to learn the German word for bus driver, librarian, pilot, mechanic. And inevitably, I'd have some bright spark whose father was an oncologist. And not only would I not know the German for that, but it just made things harder. And I would teach the names of animals, and I would want them to learn 10 or 12 basic words for animals and just get those 10 or 12 words down and learn pig and rabbit and dog and cat and horse and cow. And inevitably, there'd be some kid who had a pet that I'd never heard of. And again, that I didn't know the German or the French for. I now know that a quail is a Wachtel in German, but I didn't know that when I started teaching. And so out of this, without much reflection, I adopted a practice that all of my colleagues used to get around this, because it used to bother us when students would be writing tests And they would get to a question on the test that says something like, what does your parent do? And they would not be able to remember the German word for freshwater biologist. And so they would just write nothing. And then they would lose marks on the test, and then they would fail, and then that would look bad for us. And so what we tended to tell them was, you know, when you're in a test, you just need to write a German word down, right? If you can't remember the word for what you want to say, then just write down a German word that you know, because then the examiner will give you points for it. And it's all about getting points, because then you'll pass the exam and then we'll all be happy. And I did this for a couple of years until one day in my class, my students were working on something and a kid put his hand up and changed my life with his next sentence. He said, "Sir, it's okay to lie in French, isn't it?" And I suddenly realized that my interpretation of what was happening was a whole different story to what my students thought was happening. That my students' interpretation of what we were doing with them was that truth doesn't matter as much when you're speaking in French and German. Because in French and German, you can just make stuff up. You can just use whatever word comes to hand. That speaking the truth to foreigners really isn't as important as speaking the truth to normal people who speak English. Now, of course, this wasn't quite my glowing Christian ethic. This wasn't quite what I wanted students to pick up. And yet, this was what students were thinking. And I started to realize that my practices, again, this wasn't the big bad secular world teaching my student this, it was me. That my classroom practices were setting up messages, were setting up stories that I needed to be paying attention to. That my classroom had its own momentum. And I needed to think about how my students were interpreting my actions, not just what I thought was happening. I needed to get explicit. I started to talk to my students about when we were doing creative writing and practice, and when we were doing communication, and I wanted them to tell the truth, even if it cost. And started trying to make those distinctions much more sharp for my students in my classroom, so that they could see that my classroom had a moral landscape. I continued to learn. I was a language teacher. 100 years ago, if I'd been teaching German, my textbook would have looked like this, with an old font and lots of grammar. It was interesting, this textbook is from about 100 years ago. The first example here, the sentence is, "Das Kind ist arm," the child is poor. Poverty came up as a topic. But it came up in such a way that the textbook is clearly not expecting you to actually think about it. It's just for the purpose of manipulating grammar. So 100 years ago, we would talk about poverty in the foreign language classroom, but also carefully practice not caring about it. These days, well, at least when I started learning to be a language teacher, the strategy had shifted. Now we simply didn't talk about things like poverty. We mostly talked about vacations and restaurants and things like that. And we practiced sentences like here, "Are you going to the library?" "No, I'm going to the pub." And the argument here was this was practical language that people could use, and we were trying to connect it to the real world, and we would spend a lot of time reading French restaurant menus and booking into hotels and so on. And I just started worrying about the fact that the French and German people in my textbooks were not human. That they never suffered. They never cried. They never died. They never got seriously ill. They never protested or lamented anything. They never celebrated anything very big. They pretty much went shopping, went on vacation, went to the pub. The pictures, I started looking at the pictures in my textbook, which tended to be either cartoon pictures of Germans going about their daily routine, getting up, showering, eating breakfast, picking up a parcel at the post office, going to the pub. They always went to the pub or the movie theater. It was they never volunteered at the soup kitchen or went to visit their grandmother or went to join a political protest, or they always went to the pub or the movie theater at the end of the story. So it would either be cartoon pictures of Germans doing consumer things, or it would be awkwardly posed stock photos of Germans looking as if they wished they were elsewhere. And illustrating the structure of the average nuclear family. So again, I started to be worried about the pictures that were in my classroom. What story were they telling about what it means to be human? About the lives of German people? About their humanity? I started worrying about the sentences that we spoke in class. In fact, I started to realize that If you could actually write out every sentence that we said together in a language class for a year, that a very large proportion of them would turn out to be first-person sentences. We spent a lot of time practicing how to say, my name is, this is where I live, this is my brother, this is my sister, these are my parents, this is my house, this is my bedroom, this is my garden, this is my favorite book, this is my favorite movie, this is what I did yesterday evening, this is what I'm going to do next week, this is my favorite food, I like biology, I don't like mathematics. Could I have a hotel room for 2 nights? Could I have the steak and fries, please? I would like a ticket to Hamburg. We spent most of our time using German to ask people to give us things or to tell people about ourselves. In fact, it became telling to me that we talked about learning to speak a foreign language, but we never talked about learning to hear a foreign language. As if the real reason for learning somebody else's language is just so that you can tell them stuff, not so that you can actually enter in relationship with them and listen to what they have to say. I came across this sentence in a book about the Reformation. Sin was no more than self-love. Sin consisted in valuing oneself over others and conceiving of others and of God in terms of one's own self. It was to measure others in reference to oneself, to enter into social relations out of self-interest. I read that sentence, to enter into social relations out of self-interest. I thought, this is what I teach students. This is what I do. I teach students to enter into social relations out of self-interest. What do I say when students ask me, why have I got to learn German? Well, the standard answer was, it'll help you get a job. Not it'll help you love your neighbor. So the story that I was telling my students sounded a lot like the Reformation definition of sin. I thought, here I am, mighty man of God, crusading for the faith in education. I should have a business card made, David Smith, teacher of sin. In fact, I started to suspect that an awful lot of the structure of my classroom, the sentences we used, the pictures we looked at, the exercises we did, the situations we practiced, was basically egocentrically structured. And I realized that doing devotions at the start of class wasn't going to change any of that. In fact, it might just model hypocrisy. It was the practices that needed to change. If the story was going to change, I couldn't just come in and tell a Christian story over the top of this set of practices. That would be kind of weird. So again, I was learning gradually and painfully that the practices of my classroom told their own story. And that was the story that I needed to start learning how to pay attention to. I started making changes. I found some ways forward. One that I've talked about in Australia a few times before in a different way was I started using photographs of real Germans in real historical situations who had to make difficult decisions to try to give my students a glimpse of Germans as humans. One of the stories that I use quite a lot is of Sophie Scholl, a student in Munich in the 1940s, who was part of a small group of Christian students who decided to resist the Nazi regime in Germany, distributed leaflets encouraging people not to support the war effort. And after about 18 months, they were caught and interrogated and put on trial and beheaded. And I built a whole unit around this story that I've used for years teaching German, using real photographs and creating some empathy in my students for the lives of Germans and the difficult decisions that they have to take before God. The first time that I taught this unit about Sophie Scholl, I walked into the classroom full of anxiety. I thought, I'm going from At the Cafe to Conscientious Objectors in the Third Reich. There is no way this is going to work. But it went pretty well, and I taught the initial story with some photographs, and we got through to some exercises that I designed. This was one of them. Now, this was sort of later in the unit, and you can see at the start here, I've got 7 German sentences, and they're each split in half, and you've got to match the 2 halves of the sentences. And so the 7 sentences here, the first one says, death sentences for preparation for high treason. That's a newspaper headline from 1943. Second one says, murdered in the name of the people. That's a magazine headline from the 1980s about the same story. Number 3 is from Sophie's sister saying, why do we have to do something about this? Why can't somebody else do this about whom the Gestapo doesn't know as much? Number 4 is Sophie's father, just before the executions, saying to her, you will go down in history because there is still a justice. Number 5 is Christoph Probst, one of the other students, a few moments before the executions. He said, in a few minutes, we'll see each other in eternity. Number 6 was the prison warder. They behaved so fabulously bravely, the entire prison was impressed. And number seven was Sophie herself. So many people have died for this regime, it's about time somebody died against it. My thinking here was, first of all, I just wanted students to match the two halves of the sentences as a way of testing that they understood the German. Just get the vocabulary down, figure out what's going on. Then I wanted them, and this is the second part with the pictures that you can see a little of at the bottom, I wanted them to match the sentences with the person they think said the sentence. So here I wanted to see if they were connecting with the characters in this real life story, and if they could think through which kind of person might have said this kind of sentence. I gave out the worksheet. One of my best students sat and stared at it for 3 or 4 minutes and then raised a hand and said, "I can't do this," reawakening all of my insecurities and anxieties about the non-viability of this mode of teaching. And I sat down next to her and we worked through the vocabulary together and we worked through the sentences, and I discovered that she understood every word on the sheet. She could actually translate the sentences to me. She didn't seem to have a big comprehension problem, so I couldn't figure out why it was that she couldn't complete this exercise. So I said, "Look, do it for me and talk aloud about what you're thinking while you're trying to do it." And she did that for me, and I suddenly realized that what she was looking for, as she tried to match the sentences and then match the sentences with the people, she was looking for grammatical clues. She was looking for a first-person verb in the first half of the sentence, a first-person pronoun, rather, and a verb with a first-person ending in the second half of the sentence. And it suddenly hit me that every time my students have been asked in a foreign language class to match two things, that was the way you did it. You looked for grammar clues. The meaning of the sentence was completely irrelevant. All you needed was to match the pronoun and the ending, and then you would get the right answer, and you would get the points, and you could move on. And so I said to her, "No, I'm sorry, this time you have to think about the meaning of what the person said and why they said it." Immediately she rattled off the whole exercise, completed the whole worksheet. And I thought, I did that. Again, not the big bad secular culture. I did that. I set up a pattern in my classroom that taught my students that in a foreign language classroom, you don't have to think about the meaning of sentences. Just look for the clues, match them up, get the points, move on. That came out of the rhythms of my teaching. And if I want that to change, I've got to change the rhythms of my teaching. I've got to change the story that's being told by the moves that I'm making in my classroom. Final chapter. If I kept going through the next 20 years, it would take a while, so I'm going to jump to the present. A few years back, I worked with some colleagues on a project called What If Learning. Many of you will know the website at whatiflearning.co.uk. And in that, we used a model for trying to think about this question of how faith is reflected in classroom practices that has three parts: seeing anew, choosing engagement, reshaping practice. Seeing anew is the imagination piece. What's my story about what I want to achieve for my students? What's my story about why we're doing this? Choosing engagement is about, what do I give students to do? How do I engage students with this story? How do they get to participate? And reshaping practice is about thinking about all of the practice details of my classroom. Where do I put the chairs? Do I stand? Do I sit? What pictures do I use? What sentences do I use? How often do I use matching exercises? Those kinds of practice questions. And what I've been focusing on here is this connection between imagination and practice. And ideally, our story should be meshing with our practices. I want to refer here to an article by Trevor Calling and Beth Green. Beth's here and presented yesterday, and I believe he's presenting again this afternoon. And it's in the International Journal of Christianity and Education. We just merged the Journal of Christian Education in Australia, that some of you may be aware of, and the Journal of Education and Christian Belief in England, and created one new international journal called the International Journal of Christianity and Education. So any of you who are doing grad work, this is one of the places you need to be aware of to keep up with research that's being done on Christian education. If you Google International Journal of Christianity and Education, you'll find its page. Now, this article just came out last week in the July issue of the journal. It's on competing imaginations for teaching and learning, the findings of research into a Christian approach to teaching and learning called What If Learning. And I want to draw two examples out of this article. The first one was from a teacher who was observed, who was teaching field hockey. Now, the imagination piece. This teacher had sat down and thought about, as a Christian sport teacher, how do I What story do I want my students to imbibe from my teaching? And he had decided that the story that he wanted to get across was that participating in sport is not just about you getting fitter and you having a good experience and you being successful. It's about the well-being of the other people who are playing the game with you. And you should be looking for the flourishing of all the people who are on the field with you, not just maximizing your own experience of participating in sport. That was the story. That was how he wanted to change the story about sport. The article says the teacher deliberately required students to engage in practices of peer coaching and to explicitly reflect on how to encourage another player in this role. Now notice he's done two things here. First, he's changed his practices. He's actually got the students teaching each other skills, and he's got them explicitly reflecting on how that's an act of care for other people. So he's both changed his practice and he's given a narrative that makes sense of that practice. The short game of hockey played at the end of the lesson illustrated powerfully how attention to practice affirmed this new way of seeing one's opponent. The researchers noted that students would automatically indicate if the ball hit their foot and other offences, regardless of whether the referee had observed them. So they watch the hockey game and they find that as a result of this changed practices, students are actually voluntarily reporting when they break the rules. They're not just playing for their own advantage. When they interviewed students after this in a focus group, here's what the students had to say when asked about what was going on in this class. Is it because in PE, part of the Christian ethos is to be, it's like some guidelines of what you should be, like you should have good sportsmanship and that, like linked with your Christian religion, to love your opponent, to be, not to, it's quite hard to explain, but not to such fall out with them. Like, loving your opponent, you've got like, say, because we're doing hockey now, like there's certain rules, and then say the ball hits your foot and it's not meant to, you honestly say to your opponent, yes, it hit my foot, so you'd be really careful. Now, this is not the most articulate theology of sport, that, but for middle school kids, it's pretty good. So what I'm seeing here in this example is this nice through line from the teacher's got a story to tell, they want to change the student's imagination about what it means to be a Christian in sport. Instead of just preaching that, they've changed their teaching practices so that students peer coach. They've had the students reflect on the changed practices. It's changed the student's behavior, and the students can articulate back to the researcher what was Christian about their hockey lesson that they just took part in. That's a beautiful loop. There was a second example that involved a mathematics teacher who was doing an exercise with a list of celebrities where the students were given information about them and asked to rank them, and then they were given more information and had to rank them again. So students would score celebrities before and after they received additional information about them and then work out the correlation coefficient using the two rankings. I almost know what that means. Ask the math teachers afterwards. Now in this case, what the teacher did was started teaching this lesson about celebrities, added a couple of new celebrities that were more sort of inspirational figures like Mother Teresa, and paused in the middle of the math lesson to do about a 3 or 4 minute devotional about how we shouldn't be too caught up with celebrities because God cares for everybody and all people are important to God, and then went back to teaching the activity the same as it was taught before. So what they did was they changed the imagination piece but didn't significantly change the underlying practices. They just tried to tell the Christian story over the top of what they were already doing. The result of this, when the researchers talked to the students, was this. The students in the focus group supported the teacher's observation in her log and interview that the significance exercise had been a distraction from the main lesson objectives. We learned from the focus group that students are aware that their teacher is a Christian and that in line with school policy, we used to a prayer being said at the end of the school day in lessons, but had no expectation that there would be a discussion of virtue in the body of a mathematics lesson. In fact, students thought that it was weird. When imagination is separated from practice, when the story floats over the top of the practices and the practices don't change, it's weird. It's like watching cricket, but the audio channel is set to a baseball commentary. Right? It's just not going to work. And I think there's two possible outcomes there. One is what happened here, which is the students are going to go, huh? This is kind of strange. This is not contributing to my learning. It's weird. There's another possible outcome that might even be worse, which is the students start to accept that this is normal, that this is what being Christian means. It means you tell a Christian story over the top of a set of practices that aren't generated by that story. Now compare that with an example that I used last time I was down here, out of a project some Christian teachers worked on to design math curriculum. I've shown this picture at a few conferences and often asked people to say, what subject area is this? And almost nobody guesses that it's a math textbook. because chapters are not supposed to be titled this way in a math textbook. The title is supposed to be differential equations or something. And math textbooks are not supposed to have this kind of photograph in them, because suffering and empathy aren't part of mathematics. And this exercise starts with a picture and a description of the tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004. Begins talking about the mathematics of wave formation. How do you describe the shape and the motion of a wave? And if you can do that, can we predict tidal waves? Turns out we can. We have early warning systems. Well, in that case, was it our fault that so many people died in Thailand and Indonesia? Is mathematics related to human responsibility for suffering? The next part of the unit goes on to talk about the mathematics of emergency aid. You need to drop blankets and food from a helicopter. How do you calculate the optimum height from which to drop those things? Because if you go too high, you'll destroy the contents and it won't help people. If you go too low, you're wasting time and fuel and you will help fewer people. So how would you use mathematics to calculate the optimum height to drop those supplies from? This is a real-world mathematics example of things we use mathematics for in the real world. It's funny how in education, when we start talking about the real world, somehow that always has to mean the world of commerce. But there's a lot of stuff in the real world. The real world's a pretty big and complicated place. And this is an example of what we use math for in the real world. And this is not just pasting a Christian story over the top of a page of sums. It's asking some deep questions about how mathematics relates to responsibility and suffering and care and serving your neighbor. And it's built into the structure of the exercises. It's not added as a commentary over the top. So my original question was this. We've talked about big cultural stories, which we should be concerned about, and the biblical story, which we should be really concerned about. The challenge in relating all of this to teaching is to get a handle on what story is being told by my classroom, whether I like it or not. To start to figure out what my actions mean, how they're being interpreted by students, and to start to figure out how to make my classroom tell a Christian story. Not just to talk about it over the top of a set of practices that I inherited from the way we do school in the Western world, but to begin to think through how I can transform my practices so that it might not be a bad thing to be called to be a teacher who's working on becoming Christ-like. But maybe this is what sanctification looks like for teachers. This long, slow process of becoming more like what you were called to be, not solving it all with a quick slogan, but committing to a lifelong process of learning, of unpicking, of redoing, of admitting that some of what you're doing isn't full of glory, and repenting, and trying again, and talking to each other, and figuring it out in community, and praying about your lesson plans, and gradually figuring out how to be a Christian teacher. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.